Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 103 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, travel writer Jonathan Gregson speaks with James McConaughey about travelling the Himalaya by unorthodox means, including a horse and an Enfield Bullet motorbike, and his mixed emotions about the now vanishing Forbidden Kingdoms.
I'm sitting with the travel writer and historian Jonathan Gregson. The camellias in the garden are in bloom, which is a reminder that an abiding subject of his work is the Himalayas. And all around us are mementos of the many journeys he has undertaken across the region. Jonathan, what is your first memory of seeing the Himalayas?
I don't know whether I can actually say I can recall it, but there's a photo of me looking at Kanchenjunga, which is the third highest mountain in the world, from Kalimpong, which is at the end of the old trade route to Tibet. And I was aged 1.5. But the family normally went up to the hills for a holiday once a year. And so it's overladen with all the subsequent visits, but it was pretty early on.
So your family were already living in the region?
They were living in Calcutta. My father had been in the Indian Army, and he was a head of a business out there. And so, yes, I had a strange Indian, Anglo-Indian childhood, but it was a post-Raj upbringing, it wasn't Raj.
There are many Englishmen who grew up in India who might, like you, have visited the Himalayas on family holidays. Why did you return to it, the region, again and again? What was it that made you want to write about the Himalayas?
Partly the most staggering scenery in the world, but also because I found the people, enormous diversity of different people, people of Tibetan origin, Bhutanese, Nepalese, people from the plains who had come up to run businesses or work in the civil service, and they all intermingled in the narrow, winding little roads of Darjeeling or Kalimpong. And the other thing was that at that point in time, half of the places that you could look at from Tiger Hill, which is at the very top of a hill above Darjeeling, were forbidden kingdoms. You were not allowed to go there. You couldn't get into Tibet, you couldn't get into Bhutan, and you couldn't get into Nepal. So the lure of the forbidden, I suppose, was a large part of it.
So the seven-year-old Jonathan looking, being offered the world, the vision of the Himalayas, but being told that he couldn't go there.
Very much so, and it made me all the more determined sometime in my life that I would make an attempt to do so.
And when was the moment that attempt first became possible?
Well, the very first time I got into one of those forbidden kingdoms was shortly before my parents left India, and we took a Dakota aircraft flight to Kathmandu. And so lax were aircraft regulations in those days that I was allowed to take over control of the aircraft as we approached the first range of hills and veered around successfully enough to make my sister airsick in the back.
No doubt very satisfying.
Extremely.
And that journey at some point changed into a professional journey, because as a travel writer you are more than merely travelling. You're also recording it. At what point did the commitment to writing about these journeys begin?
It had always been there, but one has to think of why a reader should want to hear your voice talking about a particular place. And I suppose I had a certain unique advantage, USP, whatever you like to call it, in that I went to school with the King of Bhutan. In fact, I was responsible for him being sent to the school he was sent to in England.
How responsible?
Because I was in Calcutta for the winter holidays with my family, and we were summoned to Government House, Raj Bhavan, where we had an audience with the Queen of Bhutan. And although I mucked up, I confessed to having been caned the previous year, which was not very good, they decided that it must be a half reasonable score, and they sent their son to it. And next time he duly turned up, and I ended up, I was best part of 3 years older than him. I was a bit like his unofficial minder, kept him out of trouble, stopped the bullies getting at him.
But your first book was not about as he became King Chigme, if I pronounced that correctly. Mm-hmm. It was another journey.
Yes, it was very much a journey. It was a book called Bullets Up the Grand Trunk Road. The Grand Trunk Road is the main artery that links the subcontinent all the way from Calcutta to the Khyber Pass, and has fulfilled that function for more than 2,000 years. And I decided to ride up it on an Enfield, Royal Enfield Bullet motorbike, which happened to, the prototype was made in Redditch in 1947, which made the bike exactly the same age as independent India and Pakistan. So I thought this was the right vehicle to do it in. I hadn't ridden a bike since I was a student. I had to take my tests, because back then you could do it on an ordinary driving license, and I failed the test the first time around. So it was a worrying moment. I'd been commissioned to write a book, and I wasn't going to be able to do it, but I didn't pass the test.
The choice of vehicle is so important for travel writers. It is the writer, it is the place, but it is also the mode of transport. Now, I can see the symbolic significance of the Enfield Bullet. Were there other reasons why you chose that vehicle? Surely preposterous, dangerous, breaking down. Why would you choose it?
Because you are open to the elements. And strangely, if you pull into a small village and you're on an Enfield motorcycle and you pull off your helmet, they think maybe a spaceman's arrived. But you're not a chauffeured tourist. They also might think you're a bit of a bad guy, because the Enfield Bullet is the favoured vehicle of the local gangsters.
You exploited your bad side.
There were occasions when I had to be slightly threatening to get out of trouble.
Was it dangerous?
Well, certainly in terms of the oncoming traffic, overtaking buffaloes in the middle of the road. I probably had about two near misses a day on average. I had two accidents. One was at a level crossing where the bus in front of me was told he was on the wrong side, so he just reversed over me, causing damage to the bike, but one of the rear wheels passed my head by about 6 inches.
The other choice you have to make as a travel writer, even on a route as well defined as the Grand Trunk Road, is which direction to go. Was it always obvious to you?
It was obvious to me in terms of the story of partition, because that its starting point is British Rule. And British Rule in northern India started in Calcutta. So in a way, I was moving up country, away from the traditional basis of power, and I ended up on the Afghan border, which is very far from any power whatsoever.
This must be the moment to ask about humour in your books. You don't do it as much as some travel writers whose every step is a misstep, but it definitely seems important. There's a wonderful story you tell about impromptu singing a song you refer to as the masturbation intermezzo to entertain a group of people. How do you make that balance between the very serious journeys you're doing, and dangerous as you've described, and this human, humorous quality? Is it something you're very conscious of as a writer?
Possibly things which didn't seem very funny at the time, when written afterwards, reflection can sound funny. And a lot of it is to do with deflating a tense situation, or indeed making things which might seem too serious or too horrific to see the humorous side in it. I mean, you know, the real subject of what is up the Grand Trunk Road isn't riding a motorcycle. It's about partition and the horrors of those times. And I talked to many people who had settled beside the Grand Trunk Road, because that's been their way of escape, and they've stayed there ever since. A bit of humour is needed to lighten that mix. Otherwise, it would get pretty depressing, I think.
Anyone who's travelled in the Himalayan region is familiar with frustrations. Forbidden kingdoms, checkpoints, borders, military crossings. Would you rather the region was open, or is that frustration a necessary part of your writing?
Well, if it was completely open, I think it would change or lose its traditional characteristics even faster than is the case now. While I was something of an oddity to be a tourist riding an Enfield motorcycle in India, now you can hardly get through a pass for the number of organised Enfield tours, which are all full of wealthy urban young males seeking an adventure in the high Himalaya. And I think the difference between them and myself is they show virtually no interest in the Tibetan culture, and I found it fascinating.
I mean, obviously, to take an Enfield all the way up the Grand Trunk Road is some feat, not least of endurance. Is there a particular journey that you're most proud of?
I think going by horseback to the capital of the Kingdom of Wustang, Lomantang, which is, or was, because it's no longer a kingdom, the most isolated capital in the world, and involved going over extremely high passes and through a landscape which was more like a moonscape in places. The feeling of achievement of arriving at that walled city and dismounting from the valley and thinking, we've got here, that was quite something. Wustang is an incursion into Tibet from the north of Nepal, but historically, since the 18th century, the kings of Wustang accepted the overlordship of the Nepalese kings, so it's territorially a part of Nepal. Its culture, its language, and the landscape are very much the Tibetan plateau. It is probably like what vast parts of Tibet were before the Chinese invasion of 1950. It is a survival, and because of its isolation, it's been preserved in aspic, but now, speaking of journeys, they're building a road down from Chinese-occupied Tibet, down through the valley, and whether that isolation will remain is understood.
Will it be regretted by you, the end of isolation?
I don't think it will be regretted by most of the local population. Even when I was there, many of the things that were needed for life, or which were possibly new to them, their life, like soap, were imported from China, taken by truck to near the border, and then taken on mule from there.
It sounds like a survival from a medieval period. Is there any sense that you were travelling back into the past?
Very much so. Upon arrival at the walled city, everyone has to dismount apart from the king, the only person to enter on horseback, and there were people bringing out the night soil on their backs in wicker baskets, because there is no plumbing, drains, sanitation. And the animals are brought into the walled city at night for safety as well. It's pretty medieval.
And of course, now there is a road, the change may be moving from a walk to a gallop. Is that happening across the Himalayan region?
Yes, at different speeds. And let's face it, if you can have electricity, you're very much welcome electricity. If you can have a flushing toilet, it's better than a hole in the ground. There are many things, including better health care, better life expectation, better quality of food, which are all welcome. What I worry about is the disappearance of some languages or dialects, many of which are only survive in a very small area, and of distinct cultures. And in the case of Wustang, it is a very rare survivor of traditional Tibetan culture. I suppose that things are disappearing. On the other hand, I think a subject for travel writing is to actually look at the process of transition, which is not entirely benign, but not entirely evil, and to try and understand the dynamics of what people are giving up in order to gain something else. And that is going on in Chinese cities, in Indian villages, as well as in islands of the Himalayas.
You've written very interestingly about Bhutan in particular, where your old schoolmate was king, the king, in fact, who oversaw Bhutan's movement out of absolute monarchy towards a more democratic phase. And you've written controversially about Bhutan's role. What was it about your writing about Bhutan that caused such trouble?
It caused a certain controversy in Nepal because one of the positions taken by the King of Bhutan and his government was that they decided to hold a census, which might sound fairly innocuous, but as a result they discovered that there had been very large-scale illegal immigration into the country, economic migrants, mainly of Nepalese origin, and illegal logging, setting up of farmsteads. This is across a border which is basically jungle and steep mountain ranges, impossible to police. And it was decided that those who couldn't prove that they'd been there for a certain amount of time would not stay in the country. And in Nepal, some people saw this as being equivalent of ethnic cleansing, and certain human rights groups took up the call. So, yes, it was quite controversial to be seen to be a supporter of Jimmy.
Because what Bhutan did so distinctively was to resist normalisation, you might say, to fight, to preserve the distinctiveness of this extraordinary Himalayan kingdom. Comparing Bhutan's experience to other, the many Himalayan states and regions you visited, have they made the right decision?
I think the only really applicable comparison left is Nepal, because it's an independent state. I think that if one is looking at the overall benefits to society, that Bhutan, through a very gradualist approach to change, to introducing democracy from the ground roots upwards, starting with village councils and regional councils, and then moving to a full-blown general election, is the way that they took. And that seems to have succeeded rather better than the swinging between repression and revolutionary activity and suddenly bursting into full-blown democracy in 1990, the Jan Andolan in Nepal, which led to, yes, democracy, but a non-functioning democracy when corruption became endemic and in some ways a lot of the ordinary Nepali citizen seemed to be sliding backwards rather than progressing.
It takes me to the very beginning of your career to turn backwards, because before you were a travel writer, you were a historian. How did that change happen?
The change, well, I was doing a doctoral thesis, a bit of part-time teaching, and thought that I would probably spend my life in academia. But I've chosen a rather obscure field, like medieval history, and this was in the 1980s, and there was a huge cutback in university departments, whether it was Italian literature or medieval history going on. And I think the penny finally dropped when the Minister of Education, I think it was Keith Joseph, stood up in Parliament and said there are already far too many medieval historians. And at that point I thought, well, I better find another way to make a living, so I moved to journalism.
And in an extraordinary way, you have found a way of making quasi-medieval history popular, commercial, fascinating books. I mean, is there a sense in which travel writing is really a way to write history for you?
History has once been described as taking journeys into the past. So I think it works both ways. When one is looking at a distant period, certainly, yes, one is in a way taking journeys, but it journeys in time rather than through space. And yes, possibly I have focused on subjects which are traditional, which have in fact in some cases leapt from virtually the Middle Ages to the modern world within the space of just 50 or 60 years.
Within your own lifetime?
Within my own lifetime, yes, certainly.
Alongside your serious political engagement with the region, your historical knowledge of it, which is unrivalled, there is also a classic, I think, rather English sense of a man not quite adrift, but a man to whom surprises happen. Is there a role in your writing, and must there be a role in travel writing, for chance? What takes you by surprise?
The unexpected is what often makes for the best stories.
Strikingly, you also have a companion for many of your travels, Sarah.
Yes, my wife. I think she might come out in the books as a kind of the Sancho Panza, while I'm the mad knight on the horse.
Very self-serving.
Or indeed the motorcycle. And because she's a pretty tough lady, she's probably a lot more no-nonsense than I am. And a tough negotiator, whether it's in the bazaar or to try and get some water into a hotel room. We have our little arguments along the route, and sometimes those are the basis of more humorous episodes to lighten the mood a bit between some of the darker ones.
Are you conscious of your own character in your own books?
I suppose I have to be, because it's first person narration for the most part, and so my character is part of the voice that I'm using to put over all the other information. And I don't assume a character which I'm not. So there are times when I'm foolish, there are times when I'm ready to give up, and there's times when I'm very angry and probably do things I shouldn't do.
It's one of the things I most like about your writing, is that you don't mythologise yourself. It's very strong. So many travel writers, at some level, you're very conscious that they are the hero of their own narrative. Is that a peril for travel writing?
It depends what you're writing about. I mean, if you're writing something which is about going to the Antarctic or mountaineering, then I couldn't do those kind of things, but the kind of the heroism and endurance and all of that is an integral part of achieving the goal, and so is an integral part of the voice that tells it. In the Indian subcontinent, I'm in a completely the opposite pole. I'm a kind of a white sub-Saab wandering around in new countries, don't control them anymore, and I'm very conscious of not being the arrogant, imperialistic pimp. And so I suppose I might come over as a bit of kind of self-conscious anti-hero rather than hero. But that's how I feel when I'm in India. I'm very sensitive to other people's reactions to myself, and not, you know, coming over as arrogant.
Do you ever confuse your actual memory of something that happened while you were travelling with your account of it in the book? Does the book replace the memory?
It's an interesting question, and I think sometimes, yes, it does. Because it's the distillation of that memory, even when you're writing the book, that overlays the original memory. So it's a bit like a palimpsest. You're putting layer upon layer upon layer.
Do you take notes while you're going along?
Not on the back of a motorbike, unless I was completely exhausted at the end of the day riding up the GT road, I'd make notes. But more often, in some small rest house or businessman's hotel by the side of the road, I get off the bike, and my wife would say, "You must come and talk to Mr. Mukherjee. He's got an incredible story to tell about partition." And I'd go, "Oh no, I'm too tired."
Jonathan Gregson, thank you. It's been a privilege speaking to you for the Royal Literary Fund. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was Jonathan Gregson in conversation with James McConachie. You can find out more about Jonathan on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 103, which was recorded by James McConachie and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 104, novelist and non-fiction writer Miranda Miller works to finish a novel, visits an exhibition related to an old one, and considers whether she wants to be a brand in the brave new world of 21st century publishing in her audio diary. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.